Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Coffee with Craig, where we talk about all things firearms, firearms policy, Second Amendment advocacy, politics, culture, movies, you name it, we're talking about right here on Coffee with Craig. So please take a moment, like and share this program so that your friends can join in the conversation. Whether you're watching us on YouTube or on Facebook, or you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Apple iTunes or Spotify, or any one of the other many different ways that you can listen to us, please make sure to tune in on a regular basis and encourage your friends to do the same. Also, please visit fpcgear.com. That's fpcgear.com. I know it's after Christmas. Maybe you didn't get the gift that you wanted. Well, now's the opportunity for you to treat yourself. Please make it a point to go online. Go to fpcgear.com. You'll find t-shirts, you'll find hoodies, you'll find coffee mugs, all promoting your love of the Second Amendment. The great thing, though, is that every dollar that you spend will go right back into the fight for your right to keep and bear arms. So you can support the Second Amendment, and you can look good doing it. That's fpcgear.com. All right. Let's talk. You guys, you know, we've been talking a lot about lawsuits lately, right? And that's because there's a lot of things that are going on. One of the things we're realizing now with the change in the Supreme Court, and really with the wave that the nation seems to be going, is that there's going to be an opportunity for us to be able to fight for your rights, for our rights, for our right to keep and bear arms in the courts. But if that's going to happen, it's going to take the work of lawyers and attorneys to be able to come up with and identify these specific areas where our rights need to be protected. And one such area has to do with the prohibition of being able to purchase handguns in a state in which you do not permanently reside. So there's been a lawsuit filed by the Firearms Policy Coalition, Firearms Policy Foundation, and some other partners. We're represented by a good friend of the Firearms Policy Coalition, Mr. Donald Kilmer, who's here to talk with us about the case. Don, how you doing today?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Excellent, excellent. Do us a favor. Why don't you let our folks know what's going on with this particular case?
Okay, this case is out of the state of Texas, and it is currently lodged in the Fifth Circuit, the circuit court that covers Texas, Louisiana, and Arkansas. The Fifth Circuit there reversed the trial court where we initially won the case. When I say we, I was not involved in the case at the trial court stage. Alan Gura, attorney for the Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep and Bear Arms, is lead counsel on that case, and he's representing Russell Mance, who is the FFL, and Tracy Hansen and Andrew Hansen in the Texas trial court, where they won, and then the Fifth Circuit reversed the case. It received an en banc consideration, but en banc review was not granted. There were several dissents from that. In other words, there were some judges on the Fifth Circuit who wanted to take a second look at the case, but there weren't enough of them to make that happen. So Mr. Gura filed a petition with the U.S. Supreme Court to ask them to review the Fifth Circuit's decision for any error with perhaps the possibility of getting that reversed.
Okay, so in other words, what you did was we filed a brief requesting that that this case actually get heard, and the whole idea is that you can purchase long guns if you go to another state, but you're not allowed to purchase handguns if you go to another state. Am I correct on that?
Yes. Just to be clear. The people that I'm representing, Firearms Policy Council, the Cal Guns Foundation, and the other foundation, Firearms Policy Foundation, also joined with Madison Society in there in Modesto to hire me to file what's called an amicus brief. Amicus is just Latin for friend. And what it means in United States court systems is friend of the court brief. It's what happens when somebody thinks that they have something more to add to the arguments that the parties have made. Mr. Gura has made outstanding arguments in this case. In fact, he did win it in the trial court. The Fifth Circuit reversed it. And so the really heavy lifting in the briefing is being done by the parties. We're briefing what are some ancillary issues or some constitutional interpretation issues. You are correct that the law that's being challenged is a federal law, not a state law. This is an odd case. The Hansons are residents of the District of Columbia in Washington, D.C. There's only one federally licensed firearms dealer in Washington, D.C., but he does not keep an inventory of guns. He simply agrees to transfer guns to residents of the District of Columbia who basically contract to have guns shipped from other federally licensed firearms dealer in the other 50 states. This can be very cumbersome and very expensive. The Hansons had traveled to Texas, saw some guns that they wanted to buy from Mr. Mance, who was a licensed dealer in Texas. The Hansons are law-abiding citizens, obviously. It is lawful for them to purchase the handgun that they wanted under Texas law. It is lawful for them to purchase the handgun that they wanted under Washington, D.C. law. The problem is there's a federal statute that does not permit a dealer in-state to transfer a handgun to an out-of-state resident. This law came about in 1968 under the Gun Control Act. It was ostensibly for the purpose of preventing people from crossing state lines, bad people from crossing state lines, and who were unknown to the local community and buying guns to commit crimes. The law itself is arguably obsolete since we are now 50 years past the gun control of 1968 and we have instantaneous communication over the internet. The FBI and the Department of Justice for the federal government conducts what are, for all intents and purposes, instantaneous background checks. So the actual reason for the law to exist, to prevent out-of-state lawbreakers from purchasing firearms in a community where they're not known, is completely irrational now. The whole country now relies upon computerized records and instantaneous background checks to check to see if people are prohibited or in a prohibited class or otherwise not eligible to own firearms. So the only thing that should happen if you cross a state line to buy a gun is, do you pass the background check? Is the gun lawful to own in the state where you're going to return to? So that should be the only issue. The federal government made the argument to the Fifth Circuit, and the Fifth Circuit bought it, that it was too difficult for the federally licensed firearms dealer to ascertain whether the firearm that the person was purchasing would be legal in the jurisdiction that they were returning to. That's a bit of a specious argument. It's a bit of a straw man argument. The federal government and the ATF specifically publishes an entire publication. I don't have the publication in front of me right now, of all 50 states' laws. So the FFL merely has to say, well, you're in Texas and you're here from Iowa and you want to buy this gun. Well, is this gun legal for you to own in Iowa? Well, he pulls out his handy dandy ATF publication that publishes the gun laws of all 50 states and says, well, yeah, you can own this gun in Iowa. Here, make the sale and you're down the road motors.
In fact, I'm pretty sure that should this be overturned, there would be an app within days that would include that information that dealers would be able to use.
Well, the more interesting legal argument, though, is that why should the dealer even be required to assess that information? It should be up to the gun owner himself to decide whether or not the gun that he owns is going to be legal in the jurisdiction he's going to return to. But we made a much more sublime, more subtle argument in our amicus brief. It was the second part of our amicus brief. And that was this. What if the person doesn't even have a permanent residence? What if they're one of these people who've, you know, successful, they've retired from working for life, they've decided to sell their home and live in an RV, and they'll spend, you know, 3 months in Montana in the summer, and they'll spend, you know, 3 months in Arizona in the winter, and then maybe they'll go to Florida for fall. so they actually don't have a permanent residence, is based on the state of the laws that exists now, does that person, deprived of the right to either replace a broken or malfunctioning firearm or buy a new firearm, simply because they don't have a permanent residence. They travel from state to state.
And that's not a requirement of being able to exercise your constitutional rights now, is it?
Well, no. In fact, the Supreme Court has found in prior cases, Sines versus Roe is one of them, although that case had to do with whether or not you could obtain welfare benefits on an equal footing with residents of a new state where you resided in. So the U.S. Supreme Court has already ruled that your right to travel, and it's a constitutional right to move about the country, that your right to travel cannot be trumped or overcome by the government's desire to avoid welfare expenses or something like that. In this case, the argument would be that your right to travel and move about the country should not be infringed simply because you also want to exercise your Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms.
That's an interesting point. And that was a point that wasn't made in the by the main complainant, right?
It was made in the court below, but it wasn't fleshed out as well as we would like to have seen it fleshed out. It was one of those issues that the court kind of dealt with summarily, but we think that the Supreme Court should take a hard look at it. Mostly because the Privileges and Immunities Clause, there's two places in our Constitution that talk about the privileges and immunities of citizenship. There's Article 4 of the original Constitution that talks about the privileges and immunities of national citizenship. And then there's the Privileges or Immunities Clause of the 14th Amendment that was ratified to prevent states from infringing or discriminating against people from other states. But one of the holdings that the Supreme Court made in Sines versus Roe is that the citizenship rights of the Privileges or Immunities Clause of the 14th Amendment was equally applicable against the national government as well as state governments. Okay, the reason this is important for the law nerds out there is that if you go all the way back to 2010 in the McDonald case, the McDonald versus City of Chicago, one of the Justice Thomas's concurring opinion in that case was an actual magisterial decision probably some of the best writing I've ever read on what the Privileges and Immunities Clause meant, okay? Because remember, the 14th Amendment was passed in order to rectify the oversights and, quite frankly, the travesty of justice that what slavery was in this country.
Right.
The Declaration of Independence and the original Constitution should have been enough to stand for the proposition that everybody enjoys the privileges or immunities of moving about this country. But we had a tiered personhood regime in this country for too long, and it led to a civil war, and it led to the passage of the 14th Amendment. And one of the things the 14th Amendment said was that people who are citizens of one state should enjoy the same privileges and immunities of another state when they are moving about the country. Now, The statute at issue here in Mance is a federal statute. It's not a state statute. Texas is not interfering with the Hansons trying to get this gun, and Washington, D.C. is not interfering with the Hansons trying to get this gun. It's the federal government that's interfering. And what Sines versus Roe says is that neither the federal government or the state government can interfere with your right to travel.
Ah, okay. Well, so when do you suppose we'll hear whether or not this case will be moving on?
Based on what I've seen so far in the docket activity, the United States government has asked for an extension of time to file their answering brief, which won't be due now until mid January. So, or actually the last, I think the third week of January, maybe January 21st or 22nd. And then Mr. Gurr will be given an opportunity to file a reply brief sometime after that. If whether he asks for an extension of time or not, that's on his timeline. There is no more work for, I mean, there are the amicus briefs in support of the petitioners and Mr. Gura's effort are all due to be filed today. The government will file its brief, and then its amicus will have an opportunity to file briefs as well. And then there'll be one reply brief by Mr. Gura. And then the case will go into a rotation that we call conference, where once the case is completely briefed, then the court, the justices, with the help of their staff and their clerks, will start reviewing the case. And then it'll be set for a meeting called a conference, where a decision will be made whether to take further action on the case or to deny the petition. The court could also call for further briefing. The court could hold the case over for several conference meetings. Normally it takes the vote of four of the nine justices to grant a petition for certiorari. And then, of course, you got to win the case 5-4 or better once it's accepted for review.
Okay. Now, can you think of any examples where an amicus brief or a friend of the court brief has played a significant role in a judicial decision?
Off the top of my head, no. There are, for example, there are cases where the United States government is not involved in a particular case. It might be two different parties, or it might be two states, or it might be somebody suing a state. And sometimes the court will call for an amicus brief from the Solicitor General, who is the attorney for the United States government who litigates in the United States Supreme Court. And usually when the court calls for an amicus brief from the Solicitor General, they're going to give that amicus brief a lot of weight because they're specifically asking for a legal opinion from the lawyer who represents the United States government. There are times too when the Supreme Court has called for amicus briefing from a Solicitor General or an Attorney General from a particular state on a particular issue. Amicus briefs, in order to be helpful to the court at this stage of the proceedings, need to not repeat the arguments of the parties, because the court doesn't want to just see repetitious arguments or repetitious briefing. So you need to raise a unique issue, and I think that we've done that in this brief.
Excellent, excellent. Don, thank you so much for coming on. Thank you so much for all the work that you do. We know, I was actually just talking with George Lee the other day, and another of our attorneys. You know, on this stuff, and you guys do the heavy lifting, and we our viewers very, very much appreciate the work that you and other attorneys do fighting in the courts for our rights.
Well, I appreciate you guys doing the grassroots work and pounding the pavement and getting up the resources necessary, because it is a resource intensive work. I mean, there's printing costs, there's the lawyer time as well, and you know, this is the Second Amendment is one of the original 10 amendments to the Constitution that we call the Bill of Rights. It holds a unique place, I think, in the history of American jurisprudence, because it's not a right that is necessarily litigated or sought to be enforced by elites. I mean, the First Amendment has the ACLU, the Fourth Amendment right to be free from search and seizure, and the Fifth Amendment right to be free from coerced testimony, and the Sixth Amendment right to counsel in a criminal case. Those issues are really adequately protected by professional criminal defense lawyers and professional lawyers who litigate the First Amendment. The Second Amendment, by contrast, which is a right that is virtually, you know the stats on this better than I do, not everybody in the country, not even half the people in the country, are printing newspapers or need to be able to have their right to speak vindicated. Mm-hmm. But almost everybody in this, almost half the people in this country, perhaps more, have guns. They have firearms for self-protection, for hunting, for just the enjoyment, to protect themselves in the event of the usurpation of their liberty or their threat to their life or property. And so it's a right that everybody has an opportunity to exercise as long as they're law-abiding citizens. And there are practical nuts and bolts reasons for wanting to see this right vindicated. Go back to the example of the person who's traveling around the country. Even if our hypothetical senior citizen who's touring the country in their RV maintains a permanent residence in their home state, the fact that they're out traveling for 6 or 7 months of the year and need to replace a broken or lost firearm, or they just see that Colt single action they've always wanted to buy in another state, it just doesn't make sense that they have to spend another $300 or $400 to have the gun shipped from one FFL to another FFL, or that they would have to return home to take possession of the gun before they can enjoy their property. As long as the public policy objectives of background checks to make sure criminals aren't getting guns and compliance with the law is adhered to, there's no reason why you shouldn't be able to buy a firearm across a state line the same way you might buy a car or a book or a Bible or what have you.
Yeah, well, we all know that as Justice Thomas has referred to the Second Amendment, it has become a disfavored right, or as I like to say, the redheaded stepchild of the Bill of Rights.
Yeah, but you know what? I have several nieces and nephews who have flame red hair, and I love them just as much as the other ones. So we should all strive to have that love in our heart and treat all 10 of the amendments, treat all of the Constitution as an important part of what keeps the American civil society moving forward to protect our rights and protect our prosperity and make this the country that we all want to live in.
Well, as you know, one of our mottos is all rights for all people all of the time.
Sounds good to me.
Anyway, Don, thank you so much for coming on. Everyone, Mr. Don Kilmer. All right, folks, well, that's going to be it for today's Coffee with Craig. We very much appreciate you guys tuning in. We appreciate you liking and sharing this program, letting other people know about the work that we're doing here. We are the Firearms Policy Coalition. We are the home in the fight for civil rights. Got to use them or you're going to lose them. You guys take care.